Hallelujah, prayers. Text 14. Yasamut paititam deha.
Yasamut paititam deha.
Akashan manyamopanam.
Akashan manyamopanam.
Atma jagashaya yachit.
Atma jagashaya yachit.
Sagunan ativartate.
Sagunan ativartate.
Yasamutpattitam deha.
Yasamutpattitam deha.
Akashan manyamopanam.
Akashan manyamopanam.
Prabhu, you have to be quiet in class. Atma jigyasaya yasya.
Atma jigyasaya yasya.
Saguna atyavartate.
Saguna atyavartate.
Translation. One who inquires into self-realization and thus subdues his powerful anger, which awakens suddenly in the body as if falling from the sky, transcends the influence of the modes of material nature. When one becomes angry, he forgets himself and his situation. But if one is able to consider his situation by knowledge, one transcends the influence of the modes of nature. One is always a servant of lusty desires, anger, greed, illusion, envy, and so forth. But if one obtains sufficient strength in spiritual advancement, one can control them. One who obtains such control will always be transcendentally situated, untouched by the modes of material nature. This is only possible when one fully engages in the service of the Lord. As the Lord says in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 14, verse 26, Mamsha yogya vicharena bhakti yogena sevate sagunan samati yaitan brahma bhuyaya kalpate. One who engages in full devotional service, who does not fall down in any circumstance, at once transcends the modes of material nature, and thus comes the spiritual platform. By engaging one in devotional service, the Krishna consciousness movement keeps one always transcendental to anger, greed, lust, envy, and so forth. One must perform devotional service, because otherwise one will be victimized by the moves of material nature. Om Agyana Timurandasya Agyanam Jana Shalakaya Chakshum Litanyena Tasamai Shri Purvay Namaha. We're living in a very disastrous society because no one recognizes the danger of being a servant of lust, anger, greed, illusion, envy. In fact, people think this is quite all right. The whole culture has molded people to think, oh, I'm feeling lusty at last, this is very good. Or, I'm greedy, that means I'm a healthy person, I want things. Or, I'm angry. Psychologists tell people that when you're angry about something, you should express it. That's a healthy sign. Don't just lock it up inside you. You didn't get what you want, so be angry. It's very cleansing and purifying. And to be envious, what's wrong with that? Why should someone have what you don't have? So, envy is good. Just go out and work harder or connive or cheat and get what others have. So, you have a society that you're living in which simply enrages your contaminated desires. People don't even think that these desires are a pollution. They're worried about air pollution, water pollution, food pollution. But no one is concerned about pollution of consciousness. And because they cannot see this pollution in the consciousness, they don't understand how they're being forced to work, forced to struggle, to serve these pollutions. No one thinks like this. I am a servant of lust, anger, greed, envy, illusion. No, everyone thinks, I am master. I'm in control. I'm in control of my life. I've got a big job, or else they think. I've got a little job, or I'm on the dole. In some way, I'm the master of my life. And in some way, my life is going on according to my program. Everyone is thinking like that. Now, yes, I have to make some sacrifices. There's some things I have to do. Some obligations I have to society, to the government, maybe to my family, my bodily relations. But basically, I've got good scope for expressing myself. People, they feel like that. There's opportunity for me. I may not be rich. I may not be a superstar athlete. Although certainly on the weekends, I have a go at it with my friends, playing some matches. But I generally feel like there's opportunity for my senses. And there may be some problems now, but I'm sure in the future there'll be more opportunities. So everyone goes along with this kind of false confidence. And they overlook the fact that they are being humiliated. They are being forced to serve such abominable qualities in themselves. But they don't think like that. They don't think, I'm forced to serve my lust. I'm forced to serve my anger. I'm forced to serve my greed or envy. No, they think, I'm expressing myself. So, therefore you have what Prabhupada always said. You have a society of cats and dogs. They're thinking, they're expressing themselves, when actually they're just venting pollution. And the more that they have a chance to express this pollution, the more successful they think they are. And they feel, I'm psychologically healthier. I was very lusty last weekend. Or someone did something and I got angry. Great, you tell your friends. I was really angry. And I let that person know exactly where I thought they were at. Everyone says, oh, right, you did the right thing. Very good, very good. Now, what if you, if you're an ordinary person in society, what if you go tell your friends and relatives, I controlled my senses last weekend. There was opportunity for lust, but I controlled myself. Everybody will just look at you like you're crazy. You controlled your senses? What's wrong with you? You had a perfect opportunity for the peak experiences of material life, and you controlled your senses? They even, in fact, they say it like it's some kind of disgusting word. Controlled your senses. And then anger. If you tell your friends and relatives, I really gave it to him. I really told that person, told them off, told her off. Very good, very good. That's the way to do it in this world. And envy? Everyone can understand that. If you tell your friends or sympathizers, I can't stand that person. Why do they have all those things? Yeah, you're right. Why do they have all that? We should also get. So everyone understands that. They appreciate it. Therefore, it is very difficult to have any kind of sanity in this kind of society. It's practically impossible. And people don't recognize the nature of the world they're living in and how it must collapse under them. You cannot have a society which is ruled by lust, anger, greed, envy. It doesn't work. And it always happens that these pollutions erupt into mass disasters. It always happens. It's not anything esoteric. It's not due to the changing of the millennium. It's just due to a overburden of sinful activity, sinful consciousness. It must lead to strife. Now, this is a point that sometimes even our devotees have difficulty understanding. That as soon as there is lust, there must be strife. It takes quite a bit of work, I'm speaking especially for the devotees now, It takes quite a bit of work to connect lust with strife. The effects of living in the material world and the effects of so many births in material existence are that you think, well, lust is over here, it's one department, and strife is over there, it's another department. And so that's how the illusory energy, Maya, tricks you. You think, I'll just get into a little lust, and that's all right. And then sometimes, way over here, I've got to deal with some strife. That's another thing. The whole training of Srimad Bhagavatam and Bhagavad Gita begins by allowing you to take these two so-called extremes or poles and push them together so you can see they're the same thing. Finally, you become trained up. Your intelligence is there. By knowledge, you can see. Lust and strife are the same thing. As soon as there's lust, there must be strife. And then you don't wonder why there's not world peace. Then you don't wonder why people can't get along, why ethnic groups are fighting, nations are fighting. You see that it's all because of lust. But as long as you entertain the illusion that way over here is lust, and then over here is something unrelated called strife, you won't figure out what's going on in material existence, and you yourself will be subject to be victimized again and again. Because the way Maya makes it look, the illusory energy makes lust look attractive in of itself. It just looks like a self-sufficient package of satisfaction, just the lust itself. Yeah, there'll be this, there'll be that, there'll be this sensation, there'll be this satisfaction, there'll be this kind of succor, it'll all be there in a nice package. And it becomes so blinding that you can't see what the consequences are. And this is the great malice, or the great hurt performed by society on people today. They cannot see the reactions to their actions. It's not possible. The illusory energy of the Lord does not allow that facility. You simply see lust, opportunities for lust, you get into it, and then later you wonder, well, why is there strife in the world? why isn't there world peace? What's going on? Why can't people just smile on their brother, you know, love one another? Why can't that happen? No one ever thinks it's because we have uncontrolled senses. No one ever thinks that. And it's impossible to think straight when you take shelter of the modes of material nature. There are powerful currents that are pushing us around. But we get so much into passion and ignorance, we can't see that. We don't realize how we're being batted this way and that. So someone was asking yesterday, is everything we do controlled by the modes of nature? First of all, we pointed out, your very body itself is composed of the modes of material nature. Your thinking, the mind, that's the modes of material nature. And then, you're being pushed around by the modes also. The modes are acting on the material body and mind. They don't act on the spirit soul. But by the arrangement of the Supreme Lord, the superior spiritual energy has come under the control of the inferior material energy. How can that be? There's no need to scratch your head trying to figure it out. How can the superior spiritual energy come under the control of the material potency? All the potencies belong to Krishna. As soon as you remember that, everything clicks. Ekale Iswa Krishna Arsava Vritya. There's only one controller, Krishna. Everyone else is Krishna's servant. That includes Krishna's energies. So, by the arrangement of the Supreme Lord, indeed, the superior energy, the living entities, spirit, soul, can come under the influence of the inferior potency. But not exactly. It's like a dream. But because you're identifying with the dream, therefore you suffer. There's actually never any connection between the spirit soul and the material body. Sangohayam Purusha, the Veda said. But you dream that connection. And the false ego is a wonderful device created by Krishna to allow you to dream that such a connection is there. So there you are, pure spirit soul in material existence. Now, so many people run around talking about, I am spiritual, I'm interested in spiritual, this or that. They don't have, however, they don't have the tools to analyze. They just have sentiments. Just like so many people think they're religious, they go around talking about, oh, yes, we are godly, we want to serve God, but they have no information of God, they have no tools, techniques, how to live a spiritual life within the material world. They're just left with some platitudes, some sentiments, which can't protect them against the attacks of lust, anger, and greed. Similarly, people who go around talking about, we're just spiritual, we're part of the worldwide grassroots spiritual uprising, they have no understanding of what it means to be spirit soul in a material body and material mind. It's hard for us to accept that the material body is meant for our undoing. This is the point that Srila Prabhupada would say often. The material body is not meant for your enjoyment, it's meant for your undoing. Now just think about that. Even devotees have to really struggle with that point. Because somehow or other, the body seems to be an opportunity for pleasure. And that pleasure seems to be so intense that you think, well, it's just not just, the body is not just meant for my undoing. There's some opportunity there for some joy, for some pleasant experiences. How quickly those pleasant experiences fade. If you just, for example, go to the dentist and have your teeth drilled, then you're cursing your body. Oh, I can't stand this. Hurry up, finish. Give me more narcotics. Give me more anesthesia. I can't stand this. Just a little drill, putting a hole in your tooth, and you're just, I can't stand it. I want to get out of here. Sometimes you become so sick that you just want to give the body up right away. At those moments, when they come, we forget all about the so-called pleasure potential of the body. Yet there are other moments when we think, oh, let this moment last forever. This is so fulfilling. This is solving all my frustrations. Therefore, we require training. We require a culture that's going to make human beings out of us. How to accept that the body is meant for my undoing? Well, first of all, it's going to die on you. You don't know when. And while you have it, it's causing you problems. Therefore, as Prabhupada points out in the purport here, one must perform devotional service, because otherwise one will be victimized by the modes of material nature. You have to take that body, which is meant for your undoing, and engage it in the service of the Lord. Now, you can just imagine, if you're talking to ordinary persons, normal persons in society, and you tell them, I'm engaging in the service of the Lord. People just, hey mate, that's nice, but you must be a bit loony or something. You're engaged in the service of the Lord. No one has any idea of the Lord or why you should serve the Lord. Generally, everyone's attitude is, if indeed you're going to practice some religion, if you're going to be involved with some sort of Lord, what's he going to do for you? What kind of benefits are you getting? Now, Christianity just offers you bread. The Lord gives the daily bread. But what's your religion offering you? Everyone thinks of religion in terms of, what can it do for me? You know, you always heard that story Prabhupada would tell about how the communists, they used to make this propaganda to the people that go to the church and pray and see if you get bread. The people would go to church and pray, there'd be no bread. And then the communists would say, now, pray to us and see if you get bread. And the people would do that, and then so many trucks of bread would arrive. I always wondered where Prabhupada got that story until during the communist days I was traveling in Czechoslovakia, And I actually saw big murals on walls of buildings with that exact story, the exact scene depicted. The people going to church, praying, coming out hungry. They're going to the local Communist Party headquarters, and they're praying for bread or asking for bread, and immediately big trucks of bread arrive. I actually saw a, you know, a big city, a huge mural on the side of a building. So, people are evaluating. If there is actually real religion, what's it doing for you? What kind of sense gratification is it giving you? They want to see that. Then we might accept that there is a God. We might accept that self-realization is a bona fide career. What kind of money is it providing for you? What kind of better sense gratification is it providing for you? That's their conception. All due to the bodily conception. I am this body, so religion should help the body. When you point out that real religion begins by pointing out you're not the body, oh, this is alien. This is one of those anti-human Eastern religions which deny this world and get you to simply focus on the next world. These transcendental Eastern religions which cannot properly realize that you are the body, it's part of you. People think we are part spirit, soul, and part the body. Therefore, we should gratify the body and we should gratify the spirit, soul. But to hit the point straight on, I'm not this body, therefore why should I be concerned with my material desires? That requires training, knowledge, and culture. This is what the Krishna consciousness effort is trying to provide. Training, knowledge, and culture. We're not just being theoretical. No, we want to establish a culture, a learning situation in which day by day we can grow in our understanding, in our experience. I'm not this body, I am spirit soul, I am the servant of Krishna, and let me understand Krishna. That is real human society. And you don't have it today, therefore there are so many problems. More or less, anyone who comes here and seriously considers the program here, they're refugees. They're escaping a Holocaust and coming to an oasis. There's no supportive culture or society which will supplement what we're doing here. No, you go out the door and you're just lost in a hailstorm. You're lost in a hurricane. It shouldn't be like that, though. But it's not our fault. It's not the devotee's fault that it's like that. We are doing everything to make sure that somehow the world gets some knowledge. But the way it is now, we're like an oasis in the middle of an extraordinary hurricane. People come here, they get the real thing. And then they leave and they're just blown away. Sometimes they make it back from time to time. Sometimes they can even, a few rare ones, can even grab hold of the lotus feet of the Lord and stay. They don't go back out into the storm. But this is what we're up against now. People are living in a society which goes completely the opposite way. There's not even the slight traces of old-fashioned Judeo-Christian morality sentiments available anymore. That's all been tossed aside. Everyone is completely fixed on serving the senses. That is the only reality. And then they want world peace. Then they want economic prosperity. They want no crime. They want the government to be honest. They want all these things while having uncontrolled senses, while surrendering to lust, anger, and greed. They expect the world to work out. They're so low these days, what do they think? Well, if everyone would just have sense gratification, they'd be all right. If everyone would just realize that all they want is sense gratification, then it would be world peace. Why should there be wars? Just accept that you don't want to fight, you just want sense gratification. They cannot see that as soon as there's sense gratification, there must be strife. The very activity of sense gratification causes strife. This, even for our devotees, takes some time to understand. In the beginning, when you become a devotee, you're still fighting with this imaginary dichotomy that over here is lust and over here is strife. So you have to keep telling yourself, no, no lust, no lust. But after a while, you begin to see, no lust, I don't want lust, because immediately it produces the reactions. But what is causing that dichotomy, which is imaginary? It is the illusory energy. It doesn't allow you to see both sides of the coin. You simply see one side of the coin. It's going to be a nice, lusty experience. It's going to be nice to let my senses grow wild. That'll be good, refreshing, bit of a change. I won't get into it too much, but it's going to really be nice just to uncork the bottle and get into it for a while. Maya, you notice, never lets you see the other side. You only get one side of the coin. But then the reactions come. It's quite amazing. Prabhupada gives the example that sometimes there are criminals who, even though they know it's illegal to steal, they know that others have been caught and they can see what happened to others who've been caught, still they do it. So this is our situation. We've been beat on the head so many times trying to enjoy our senses. We can see others too, how they've been frustrated, yet still, because of the modes of material nature, because of our contact with the illusory energy, we still can get these visions that sense gratification is fresh, there's something I've missed, there's some part of me that's missing because I haven't let my senses go wild. This is the amazing thing about Maya. That's why Krishna says, Daivi Hesha Gunamayi Mama Maya Jaratya. This material energy of mine, it's impossible for you to overcome. It's got that power from Krishna that you'll never figure it out. You can spend birth after birth scratching your head, wondering what's going on, and you won't get out. What is required is knowledge and the association of devotees. You have to participate in a culture of cleansing, a culture of reawakening. So that is what we're trying to offer to people. So we ourselves have to be constantly sharp in our perceptions. The devotee's sharpness is maintained by hearing and chanting about Krishna. You'll find it's amazing. You think, I've read these books so many times, I've heard it all, you're not the body, again and again and again. Yet, you just sit down in a Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita class, you open up one of Prabhupada's books, and the points just hit you like you've never heard them before. I'm not the spy. Yes. Just a few days ago, while I was coming here on Prabhupada's disappearance day, I was listening to a lecture on CD, and he just said a simple thing. You're not... Someone asked him, well, sometimes it feels like even though you have a sincere desire to serve Krishna, still, you can become overpowered by the waves of material nature that are just pressing on you, even though you have a sincere desire to serve Krishna. So Prabhupada just answered very simply, you're not the body. These things are external to you. And so I thought, yes, not the body. These things are external. Such a simple point, but by hearing, they become very powerful. Repeated hearing. That's what's necessary. There's no one-day solution. Okay, I've heard Bhagavatam, I've heard Bhagavad Gita that day. Now I'm all right the rest of the week, you know. I did my hearing for the week. I heard it. You're not the body. I heard that on Sunday. It's Wednesday. Hey, why am I being knocked out with passion and ignorance? On Sunday I heard that I'm not the body. No, this is due to naivety about material existence. We don't understand the constant presence of the modes of nature. Just like the modes are constantly working in the material world, similarly our hearing and chanting process has to be constantly working. And then when there's constant hearing and chanting, we'll have the constant desire to engage in the devotional service of the Lord. We don't want to be card-carrying Hare Krishnas. We are actively engaged in the dynamic process of bhakti yoga, giving to Krishna. That's what attracts people. That's what inspires people. Otherwise, people have no idea that there's something else to do other than serve their lust, anger, and greed. They don't know what the service of the Lord is. You tell somebody, would you like to be a servant of the Lord? And they go, what do you think I am? I think I want to be a salvo or something? That's all they think, you know? They have no idea of the spiritual energy and how it works. They have no experience. So unless they participate in a culture which provides them with that reality, they'll never get out of material life. They will never have any desire. They need the knowledge and the culture to get it. So Krishna wants that to happen. The material world belongs to Krishna. All the spirit souls belong to Krishna. He is the origin of all the energies. He wants that proper culture and knowledge be established in this world. And as Krishna's servants, we are trying to do that. Now you may say, there's so many religions running their trip. You know, the Jehovah's Witnesses, this Protestant group, that one, the other. They're all out grinding their axe, you know, on their soapbox. Okay, you can say that, and that's fair enough. This question is dealt with right in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam pulls no punches. It's all there. These sages at Naimisharanya, they're asking Sutta Goswami, there's so many scriptures, they're recommending so many kinds of activities. You help us cut through all this maze, this labyrinth. You tell us what is the essence, what is the best. So it's acknowledged right in the beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam, the first chapter. There are so many scriptures, even in the Vedic library, there's so many books, Buddhikarmani, so many things to hear, so many prescriptions. Now what to do? Because you are a sadhu. Not that you have a long beard and you're wearing saffron, but you are properly fixed in devotional service to the Lord. You please select the essence. We want to know, how can the self actually be satisfied? What to do amidst this vast ocean of scripture and things to do and things not to do? So that is Srimad Bhagavatam, right from the very beginning. It focuses on this problem. And of course, the answer, savai pum sam paro dharma, yato bhakti yoshu. Learn how to perform transcendental loving service to the Lord. That means you've got to understand Krishna, the Supreme Lord, and you have to understand devotional service. Side by side with understanding the illusory service of this world. Now, where are you going to go for that kind of education? Who teaches that? Who gives you voluminous knowledge of the Supreme Lord? Who teaches you the techniques, philosophy, and culture of devotional service? And who teaches you about the illusion of material life? Okay, you can go to the Buddhists. Sometimes it's said the Buddhists are the fastest growing religion in Australia. If you talk to people who are part of the hip Buddhist wave, you'll always see it's superficial. Yeah, I went to a retreat for 10 days. We didn't speak for 10 days. We just sat and we watched the ingoing and outgoing breath. And we got to cut down on desires. We just got to get rid of the ego. We just got to have no desires. They say things like that, but no one ever does it. Because it's not possible. You cannot live within a world of passionate ignorance and then say, I'm going to extinguish all my desires. Temporarily, you may do that. You may even get away with it. Rare persons, you can get away with just extinguishing for one lifetime. But you have not made any ultimate solution to your problem because you don't know what the proper thing is to do, what the proper thing is to desire. I always tell this story. I know in Thailand, there's one British Buddhist master. He's been there several decades. And so he was telling a story about himself without understanding the significance. He was saying that he had spent many years in the jungles in Thailand in a tiny hut just doing his meditation, Vipassana meditation on the ingoing, the outcoming breath. They have many detailed treatises explaining the different qualities of the ingoing and outgoing breath, and how by meditating on the breath you'll be aware of different things in your mind. It is all true. So, he was doing that for several years, eating very sparsely, sitting in his little hut in the tropical jungle, mosquitoes biting, whatever, didn't bother him, becoming very detached from material desires. No doubt, there is effect. So, he himself was saying that after years of this, one day, some villager walked by the transistor radio, you know, like you go to India and the villagers have these radios and they blare them. So someone came by his hut with a transistor radio and it was playing a song from the 1950s, "Tell Laura I Love Her, Tell Laura I Need Her." And he said all of a sudden, inexplicably, tears were coming down out of his eyes. He just started crying. He just became overwhelmed by the sentiment of this song. "Tell Laura I love her. Tell Laura I need her." After years of doing his meditation in the jungle. And he couldn't figure out why. When he was telling this, he just said, "Well, this just shows you the power of desire." He couldn't understand that after years of trying to extinguish his desire, he still wanted to love and be loved. That was unfulfilled. Now, how do devotees fulfill that desire to love and be loved? They understand. The love is meant for Krishna. By loving Krishna, that means you learn how to love others. He couldn't understand this, of course. Why is this happening? I spent years in the forest. And all of a sudden, someone walks by at the transistor radio, "Tell Laura I love her, tell Laura I need her," and I start crying. Indeed, the living entity has a loving propensity. So that's not dealt with in Buddhism. So here it was, popping up in him. So he just figured, "Oh, I know, I just got to get back into my meditation, watch that outgoing and ingoing breath." So in Krishna consciousness, we deal with love. We're dealing with the dynamics of love. How to make the proper connection for our loving propensities. Only this is capable of satisfying everyone. Therefore, we have transcendental loving service to the Lord. We know who is the Lord. We learn how to render service. Then there is peace. Not some kind of stale inertia, but active, dynamic peace in service to the Supreme Personality of God. So, any questions? The demigods are controlling every movement of your body, so without their assent, you can't do anything. The modes of material nature are there, but you see, within the control of the modes of material nature, you have some options, but from the Vedic point of view, there are no options at all. When the mode of passion strikes, you can choose, shall I eat garlic or onions? Now, you may make a big deal out of that choice. But from the standpoint of Bhagavad Gita, that's no choice at all. You're under the gun of passion. When lust strikes, you can choose. Will it be this partner or that partner? Therefore, as I was saying yesterday, there's an example of in New Zealand, they have a big waterfall, the Huka Falls. And so, it's There's a long river, and it narrows into a channel. And then the channel goes over the falls, and the falls widen into another river. So one man, a canoeist, he decided he was going to go over the falls in a canoe in full view of busloads of Japanese tourists. So he started at the beginning of the channel. The channel is about a half kilometer long. It's a straight channel, just flowing water, heading for the falls. So he got in, and you can imagine how skillful he's looking at first, just canoeing down a straight channel. And then he hits the falls, and he goes over the falls, comes down to the bottom, he's knocked out of his canoe, he's floundering, he's going under the water, he's coming up, he's coughing, he's gasping for air, going down again, he's lost his paddle, the canoe's far away, all the tourists are watching. Now, what would you say about his independence? Just look at his style of struggling. I've never seen that kind of flair before. I wonder what kind of swim trunks, what do you call them here, swim trunks? Yeah, what kind of bathers is he wearing? What brand is that? A world's record. I never saw anybody keep their head above the water for 60 seconds before going down again. Amazing. This is the Western view. Look at that style. He's got independence. He's being creative. He's expressing himself. Look at the way he chokes up water. Look at his eyes starting to bulge. Oh, amazing. What character. This is how Western people analyze material existence, to say that they have independence, to say they're being creative. Of course, what are the tourists thinking on the shore? Sky's finished. He's going down. And this is the viewpoint of Bhagavad Gita. Why pay attention to the brand of your bathers when you're drowning? Why pay attention to the way that you spit out water as you stay above the surface of the water for 30 seconds before you go down again? Why waste your time on those things? You are drowning. You're a dead man. Unfortunately, when people hear this kind of thing, they think, oh, this is just the negative Vedas. No, this is reality. Just like you would never, when a man is drowning like that, you would never waste time considering his style of drowning. You'd say, he's drowning. Why did he do that? So the whole point of Bhagavad Gita is, why did you jump into material existence? Once you jump into the falls, you're a goner. Never mind your style of struggling. But we're so puffed up. That's what it is, pride. We're so puffed up. We just, look at my style. I'm struggling. You've never seen a style like this before. Who cares? You're going down. Krishna says, never mind what planet you're on in this material world. From the highest planet to the lowest, they're all unfit for habitation. So, once again, we're coming down to hearing and engaging in a process to realize what we hear. Otherwise, these things are tough to understand. You have to switch your perspective completely. That is Krishna consciousness. Change your perspective from your polluted viewpoint to Krishna's viewpoint. Now, I'm sure that Bhorijan Prabhu could also give precious illumination to your point, to your question. Oh, yes. No, he was finished. In full view of busloads of Japanese tourists, he was finished. So once again, try to understand our Western contamination. We miss the forest for the trees. We're just concerned with his style. Oh, my lifestyle, my self-expression, my becoming aware of myself, my reaching my own potential. You heard all that, right? We get so fascinated with that and forget what's actually happening. We can't even see it. We're in the process of drowning. Who cares about your world's record for keeping your head above the water for 30 seconds? Who cares what style of bathers you're wearing? This is the power of Maya. Once again, we're getting back to how we don't see what's going on. We just see the lust, we don't see the strife. So we need to be re-educated. Our eyes need to be reworked. We need to open the eyes of ignorance with the torchlight of transcendental knowledge. It's a whole process of knowledge and culture. It's all based on hearing from Krishna. Anything else? All right. All glories to Shiva.